this on the air and everything else that you hear on KBOO at all hours, consider supporting us, kboo.fm/give, or you can text KBOO to 44321 and come be a part of our community in this community radio station.
Indeed. You put the community in community radio. Your support means the world to us, and we are absolutely out of time. We'll be back next week with more musings and noticings of today's happenings. Talk to you next week.
Bye.
Girls, we run this.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
At its core, democracy itself means rule by the people. KBOO exists to give a voice to all of the people in our community, not the business with the most dollars to spend. If you feel like sharing your love of democracy and your love of KBOO, get the limited edition KBOO Sounds of Democracy t-shirt, designed by our fantastic graphic designer, Michelle Mouse. You can order yours right now at kboo.fm.
Tune in to KBOO every Friday at 6 p.m. from September 15th to October 15th for KBOO's Hispanic Heritage Month series. Join KBOO in celebrating and paying tribute to the contributions and enriching influences of Hispanic and Latinx Americans and their ancestors. You'll hear from volunteer producers from Buscando America, Boogie Pachanguero, Noticias en Español, and more. Again, that's KBOO's Hispanic Heritage Month series, every Friday at 6 p.m. from September 15th to October 15th. Here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Just Solutions, a podcast from Free Speech TV, featuring inspiring conversations with activists, community leaders, and others working to make our world a better place. I'm Maeve Conran, and on today's show, we look at the intersection of disability rights and reproductive rights. The Free Brittany movement has brought much needed attention to the conservatorship system. An estimated 1.5 million Americans are under some form of a conservatorship. That's where a court appoints a third party to make personal, financial, and medical decisions on their behalf. Journalist Sarah Luterman has written in The Nation magazine about the intersection of disability and reproductive rights and how many women in conservatorships are forced to take birth control. From Free Speech TV, Just Solutions.
Thank you so much for joining us. Of course, so many people have become aware of this issue because of the high-profile nature of what's happening with Britney Spears. But as you write in The Nation magazine, disability rights advocates are not in any way surprised by what we're learning about what Britney Spears has been subject to. And in fact, the forced sterilization, not just forced contraceptive use, but forced sterilization has a long history in this country. I mentioned there that 1.5 million adults, that's the estimation by the AARP, but because of the scant data that's available, we're not even sure if that's an accurate figure. Give us a sense of the scope of the problem. How many people do you think are under these type of conservatorships right now?
I mean, I don't have a reason to doubt the AARP number. Their guess is as good as anyone's. There's like basically every state has its own system. There's not really any like public federal reporting. There aren't really federal standards about like what a conservatorship or sometimes called guardianship should or shouldn't have in it. So I usually use the AARP's estimate in my own work because they're the only people who've made an estimate. it's really unclear. I'm actually not even sure what methodology they used, but they are the only people who have made an estimate. So I do usually just roll with that.
Well, in your article in The Nation, and you've written a few times about this, and you've written extensively about disability rights and politics and various different things. But this particular issue, as I said, this has a long history. The forced sterilization and the forced use of contraceptives has a long history in this country, and you outlined that in your article. Could you just take us through that and why so many people that you spoke to are not in any way surprised about what's happening to Britney Spears?
Yeah, so in the United States, we have a long history of sterilizing people, particularly with intellectual disabilities, mental health, and mental health and mental illness. So basically, back during the around like the 1900 to the 1920s, was sort of the peak of the eugenics movement in the United States. The idea behind eugenics is that that you could sort of improve the race, usually the white race, if we're going to be totally honest here, by selectively breeding people the same way you do with like dogs or horses. So this was an incredibly popular idea, led to the state sterilizing hundreds of thousands of women. In California, actually had one of the largest forced sterilization programs, and eventually sterilized about 20,000 people. They actually recently have just passed a bill that's waiting to be signed to pay reparations to the survivors of that sterilization. Sterilization also often broke along racial lines and not just disability lines. So, for example, Black women in the South were often subjected to sterilization. It was so common that it was called a Mississippi appendectomy. And in Puerto Rico, about a third of adult women there at one point were sterilized by the U.S. government, or by U.S. government sponsored doctors.
This definitely seems to be a gendered issue, insofar as women are much more likely to be sterilized if they are under some type of conservatorship or guardianship. Now, you mentioned a much broader sterilization program there, but I know folks that you spoke to say it's more likely to be women who are subject to this.
Yeah, that actually surprised me. I mean, I've been covering these issues for a long time, and I was actually really surprised by how heavily gendered the issue was. One of the lawyers I spoke with, I think, said that like maybe people are getting vasectomies for their male children with disabilities, but like he's never heard of it happening, basically. So it seems like a large degree of the concern has to do with people who can give birth and with pregnancy. But that's not how it's normally framed. So, for example, in California, because they had one of the most advanced eugenics programs in the United States, which actually was an inspiration for the Nazis, unfortunately, they also have a law that prohibits sterilizing someone for the purpose of disability. However, what that means is that people just look for other reasons. So, like, for example, there's a court case in which, like, a woman... Her mother asked the court for her to be sterilized because she has like period cramps and migraines. And like, you know, for you or me, like as people who aren't under conservatorship, like if we have period cramps or migraines, like that's not even like fifth line treatment. Like that's, a hysterectomy is not how you deal with that. But that's like the reasoning that gets used in a lot of cases for people with certain kinds of disabilities in the court for sterilization.
Now, and that particular court case that you cite and that you write about in your article shows how vulnerable people in conservatorships are in the court system. They really do not have adequate legal representation, as we've seen through the Britney Spears case. She's recently been allowed to select her own attorney, but many, many people do not have adequate representation. And so I believe in that case that you just mentioned there, the mother went to the judge who said, well, I don't really like your arguments, but I kind of agree with the ultimate goal of this. So
yeah,
he rubber stamped it.
Yeah. I mean, actually a lot of the time, so like in Oregon, for example, people are supposed to go to the court when they're going to do a sterilization. but oftentimes they don't. It actually is relatively rare that people actually follow the procedure that they're supposed to follow when getting someone under conservatorship or guardianship, as it's called in Oregon, sterilized. A lot of doctors will just treat it like any other medical procedure, which it's not.
What are some of the reasons that are given? You mentioned in that particular court case that the mother said she was concerned because her daughter was suffering heavy cramps during her period and also migraines. That was a reason given for sterilization. But when we're seeing this happen over and over again, what are often the arguments that are made in favor of this? Because this will ultimately be done by a medical practitioner. So I'd imagine there must be some sort of reason that's given that must pass some level of a medical reason as to why people are getting these major, major interventions performed.
Yeah, so I don't think that the reasons are explicitly eugenic anymore, at least not in any like conscious, overt sense. Because, like, I mean, if you were to ask someone like who's seeking a sterilization why they're doing it, and I've done that before for other people, like, but there's another piece I was reporting on that might come out later, where I talked to someone who was involved in the sterilization of her sister. And like, she was like a pretty, like, you know, liberal, progressive person. She was, you know, she had like a Black Lives Matter flag in the background during the Zoom interview. And when I asked, like, and when we were talking about it, she just casually sort of said like that it was necessary, that it was something that sort of like had to be done because, like, for her sister's own good. And so that's like the big difference between how this kind of sterilization used to function during the eugenics era versus now, is that, like, instead of being for like the good of like the race, the white race as a whole, it's sort of seen as being for the good of the individual. And, you know, sometimes that might be true. I mean, most women use some form of birth control at some point in their lives. But it also might not be true. And sterilization is a very permanent solution.
This idea that this is for the good of the person, I mean, that really underpins the conservatorship or the guardianship program. And certainly, as we're seeing in the Spears case, that she was deemed to not be able to act in her best interest, and this system was set in place. One of the startling things that has emerged from that, but as we have said, this is not a surprise to disability rights advocates who say, you know, the hashtag not just Brittany, is how you're essentially stripped of all your rights when you are under a program like this. We've heard that very often you can't have your own legal representation. You really are, as I said, completely stripped of your human rights. I mean, these are pretty significant, and the fact that very often they're never reversed.
Yeah, there are some disability advocates who call conservatorship civil death, because the idea is that you just lose all of the rights that an ordinary citizen has. You sort of, in a legal sense, stop being a person. And I'm really excited about like the not just Brittany hashtag, because I really want people to think about this in like a holistic sense. Like, Britney Spears should not be going through this, but also maybe no one should be going through this. Like, maybe there's a systemic problem here. And so I'm just really excited to see people's interest in Britney Spears sort of ballooning out to this broader civil rights question.
Given that the overwhelming idea behind these programs is to help people who can often be incredibly vulnerable and in most cases really can't necessarily make decisions from themselves, what are some of the alternatives? You know, we want to recognize that people still have agency, still have autonomy. How can we change, abolish, or adapt these programs to give people more rights, or recognize the fact that they do have agency and autonomy?
Yeah, so in schools, when we're addressing things like special education and accommodation, the standard is what's called a least restrictive environment. So like the least intervention necessary the most independence possible for the child is what is best. But we don't have that same standard for adults under guardianship or conservatorship. So there are like some other alternatives to guardianship that I think are really promising. I'm particularly interested in supported decision making, which is has been mostly used in people with intellectual disabilities so far, but there's actually been a case in DC recently involving a woman with dementia. And the idea is to sort of, instead of the person losing all of their civil rights, they have a group of advisors. And depending on the state and what pilot program we're talking about, those advisors might be informal, like family and friends. They might be more formal, like they might be court appointed. And those advisors help the person make as many decisions as they can with advice and guidance. And I think that it's a really interesting system, because I guess I want to push back. Like, there are always going to be people who might not be able to understand or communicate specific kinds of decisions, but I think fundamentally everyone can make decisions. Part of being a human being is having preferences, wanting things, not wanting other things. Like those are just fundamental to humanity. And they're true for people with disabilities and for people without disabilities.
You're listening to Just Solutions, a podcast from Free Speech TV, featuring inspiring conversations with activists, community leaders, and others working to make our world a better place. Today, we're looking at the intersection of disability rights and reproductive rights in the wake of the Free Brittany movement. Journalist Sarah Luterman has written in The Nation magazine about how many women in conservatorships are forced to take birth control.
It does seem that there's a bit of a patchwork quilt effect insofar as different states have different regulations about this. Yeah. Do we need some type of overhaul at a federal level of the system? And I know that there has recently been some legislation, bipartisan legislation introduced really on the back of the hashtag Free Brittany movement. What are your thoughts on what's happening at a federal level? And is that something that's really needed?
Yeah. So there's like a couple different federal efforts, and some of them are more promising than others. So, for example, the Circus Act, it's an acronym that stands for something, I guess, after the Britney Spears album. But like, that was really like a publicity stunt, because if you actually like look at the proposals they're making, like they're requiring that in order to receive birth control, if you're under guardianship or conservatorship, you have to give written consent, which is like a ridiculous standard. There are a lot of people who can make decisions about their own reproductive autonomy but might not be able to read or write. Like, those aren't the same thing. So it's sort of just like a silly idea. I don't think that's going to go anywhere. But then there's like these bigger bipartisan calls. I know Elizabeth Warren signed on to a letter calling for more bipartisan reform, and that looks a lot more promising. I'm especially interested in sort of the call for more and better data collection, because like, just step one to fixing a system is knowing what's going on, and we don't have a good concept of that because there just isn't any large-scale federal monitoring or standards. So I'm really interested to see where this goes, but it is going to be slow going, unfortunately.
Is there anything that we should be proud of when it comes to disability rights right now in 2021 in the US?
Well, I'm personally really excited by the unusual and really fantastic number of disability advocates who have transitioned into the federal government and the White House under the Biden administration. I'm especially excited about Dr. Kim Nackstadt, who is a policy advisor for President Biden on disability. She's part of the Domestic Policy Council, and that's amazing. It's a game changer, because previously, the only disability advisor in the White House under President Obama had been a community liaison. Like, there wasn't a conversation about policy happening. It was just sort of about like having a relationship with a minority community. So having someone who's at the table talking about like the policy needs of the community is huge. I'm really excited about that. There's also a lot of movement around $400 billion that the Biden administration pledged to radically improve and increase home care, accessibility to home care in the United States, that I think is incredibly exciting. And we'll see if it I mean, the big concern right now is if lawmakers might like wuss out at the price tag a little bit. But it's really like the sort of thing where like we need it. It's a system that's just been underfunded and shortchanged for decades, and the result is poorer quality care and employment and employee shortages. So this is like, it's going to be expensive, but it's necessary. And I feel hopeful that Congress will do what needs to be done.
Let's talk a little bit about why that is so important and how this type of federal reform is needed. Because for so many people who are, say, relying on federal funding for their care, Medicaid, that often meant that they would have to go into some type of residential system as opposed to staying at home because the way the funding mechanism was set up. And I know there's been a big movement for many years to have the money follow the person as opposed to going straight to an institution, allow them to use that money for in-home care, which is also been proven to be a lot less expensive as well as being the choice for so many people. You know, talk a little bit more about this, because there's long waiting lists right now for in-home care, and I think COVID has also highlighted why this is an option, not just for disabled Americans, but for anybody who needs any kind of in-home care, elderly, you know, young people, that having that ability to have that care in your home is actually a very positive thing for so many people.
Yeah, I mean, so the disability rights movement, since its inception, has framed home care as a civil rights issue. And like, from like a outsider perspective, it can be kind of hard to see that. It's like, well, isn't this a service, you know? But the thing is, like, what it does is it gives people control over their own lives. I mean, some people need assistance doing really basic, they're called activities of daily living. So like getting dressed, showering, using the bathroom, and being able to get care in your own home means you have control over when those things happen. Whereas people in institutions don't necessarily get to make those decisions. People in nursing homes don't necessarily get to make those decisions. I actually wrote a piece for The Nation last year about, it's the headline's a little inflammatory. It's called "It's Time to Abolish Nursing Homes." And it's sort of about this like growing interest in moving to a more community-based system and why things are so heavily weighted towards institutions.
In addition to July being Disability Pride Month, we've seen some visuals there from some of the Pride parades that have taken place in years gone by. Obviously, with COVID, we're not seeing as many this year. It also marks the 31st anniversary of the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act. That really centered on transportation and accessibility for buildings and transit, because that was seen back then as such a crucial thing. Now we're having much broader discussions. What are the conversations that we should be having, Sarah? And you know, to bring it back to our original conversation, how what's happening with Britney Spears has really put this into mainstream coverage. But what are the parts of the story that we should really be focusing on that maybe is being missed by the media?
Yeah, so there's something that disability rights advocates say that I think is really interesting, and that's that the Americans with Disability Act is the floor. Like, that's the starting point, is just access to like things like ramps, things like Braille. Like, that's baseline. And then from there, we need to build forward. So I do think transportation is actually still a really big issue. One of the issues that the Department of Transportation has been looking into is the number of wheelchairs that are seriously damaged by airlines every year. It's actually quite a large number. They just started tracking that number last year. And it's tens of thousands of wheelchairs. Like, imagine if airlines broke that many people's legs. It would be like, we'd deal with it right away, but because it's people with disabilities, there's just sort of been a slow reaction. So it's exciting to see like more attention on that. I think that expansion of home care is absolutely fundamental. And I think that like access to the community in meaningful ways, not just ramps, but like things like library programs, things like competitive employment, things like you know, just being able to go to a restaurant, like those are things that a lot of people still don't have access to, even with the ADA. Also, sorry, I'm looking at the long list, I guess. I think abolition of subminimum wage is another thing that's sort of interesting that's coming down the pipeline. Certain people with disabilities, it's legal to pay them pennies per hour still. And so that's there's been some movement towards ending that practice. There's just so much going on and so many exciting things in store. Social Security reform, that's another one. Yeah, I'm just astonished by all of the amazing work advocates are doing in this area. It's really exciting.
You know, each of those areas deserve their own show, Sarah.
Yeah.
But before we move on, I do want to just reiterate what you said there about the subminimum wage. It's something you've written about as well, because, of course, disability rights intersects with every other form of rights, including labor rights, and that disabled adults have been subject to this, where they are legally allowed to be paid well below, as you said, pennies on for their work, and the work is often menial, often repetitive, because of this idea that there's inherent dignity in the work. However, there's no dignity if the person is not being treated with respect. You know, maybe just dig into that a little bit more. And as I said, each of these topics deserve their own show, but just before we move on, talk a little bit about why that aspect is so important for reform as well.
So outside of the disability area and sort of more squarely in the labor rights area, Sarah Jaffe wrote this really great book that I recommend to everyone called Work Won't Love You Back. I just feel like this idea that like just working has some kind of inherent dignity and value, even if you're being treated terribly, even if you're being paid nothing, is ridiculous. I find this like a lot of people who run subminimum wage workshops will describe themselves as providers. Like they see themselves as providing a service by paying people, you know, 3 cents an hour to grind little bits of metal or screw tops onto shampoo bottles or tie popsicle sticks together. Like it's absurd. We wouldn't tolerate treating non-disabled people like that, but because these people have disabilities and we have low expectations, it's sort of seen as acceptable.
Well, we started the conversation talking about the intersection of reproductive rights and disability rights. We've certainly seen a lot of disability rights advocacy groups and disability justice groups weighing in on what's happening with Britney Spears, but also the many, many countless women in particular, as we are hearing, it's a very gendered issue, forced sterilization and the forced use of contraception. Are we hearing the reproductive rights groups weighing in on this in the same way? Is there a possibility now of alliances between all these various different groups to really address some of these issues?
Yes, actually. So that's brand new. As far as I know, there haven't been any reproductive rights or reproductive justice groups that have really addressed this in terms of like sterilization of people under guardianship. So I know that I've heard some folks at NARL Pro Choice have reached out to a couple different disability organizations. And that's like really early. I don't even know what's going on yet. I'm really excited to see where it goes. Hopefully I'll have a story about that when there's more to report.
Well, of course, the media controls so much of the narrative, and the fact that many of these stories are not being told. Sarah, you write extensively about this in The Nation magazine, in other venues as well. Where can people find out what's happening right now, given that we're not really seeing the coverage that we need to on these very important issues? Where would you direct people to really engage on these topics and find out more? And then if they want to add their voices to a course of support in some of these pieces of legislation that you mentioned, how might they do that? What are some of the organizations you'd recommend?
So social media is a great place to sort of get in touch with the disability community. There's actually like a hashtag called Crip the Vote. Crip being sort of a reclamation thing that people with physical disabilities have done for the term. Sort of like how there's like a bitch magazine, you know, like just sort of this idea of taking this slur and making it your own a little bit. And so the Crip Vote hashtag is a really interesting place to get in touch with a lot of grassroots community leaders. I know the American Association for People with Disabilities has a number of initiatives they've been running. There are local chapters of the ARC of the United States that they're a really interesting organization, although they tend to vary in terms, the individual chapters per state tend to vary in terms of like where they are on disability rights. It's a very like mainstream organization. So because it's such a big tent, you sort of encompass a lot of different viewpoints. In terms of journalists who write about this stuff that I admire, Joe Shapiro at NPR is the greatest of all time. he wrote a book called No Pity that's one of the sort of seminal histories of the disability rights movement.
Well, Sarah, I really appreciate you joining us today on Just Solutions on Free Speech TV.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Just Solutions, a podcast from Free Speech TV. Today's guest was journalist Sarah Luterman. She's written in The Nation magazine about the intersection of disability and reproductive rights and how many women in conservatorships are forced to take birth control. You can read her article online at thenation.com. Find out more about us, watch past episodes at freespeech.org, and engage with us on social media. Join the conversation and let us know your thoughts at Free Speech TV. And subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. For Free Speech TV, Just Solutions, I'm Maeve Conran.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO Portland.
Good morning. This is Disability Justice, an Everyday Pursuit and Survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
And Dina Wilder,
board operator.
Before John begins his interview today, I'd like to remind you that KBOO has started their membership drive. You can support programs like ours, Disability Justice, by going to kboo.fm/give. so that you can become a monthly sustaining member.
Good morning, KBOO listeners. With me in the studio today is Ralph Gillum, former director of Club Impact. Is that an appropriate title?
Yes.
Good morning, Ralph.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Yes. How did you get started working with people with disabilities?
Good question. I started working with people with disabilities as a second career. Before working with people with disabilities, I was in a whole nother setting in furniture manufacturing. So yeah, sounds kind of weird, huh? So I decided I wanted to make a career change. I was influenced a lot by my wife, Cynthia. I ended up going to school at PSU, and I got a master's degree in special ed. So it took me a while to find a home, and for meaning what do I want to do within special ed. I liked working with older students. I liked the focus on jobs, job development. I got a job with Portland Public Schools in their transition program. These programs are available to post-high school graduates from, to students that are identified as special ed eligible that don't graduate from high school with a standard diploma are eligible for two or three more years until the end of the school year of their 21st birthday. So I loved that program. I enjoyed working with those students. There was still quite a focus on jobs, job development, experiencing different places to work at, to identify preferences, all of that. And then, of course, there's other things that you do in a program like that. Independent living skills, cooking, budgeting, all kinds of things, so that when a person leaves school with a disability, well, it's more challenging. Where are you going? What are you going to do? What things do you need to be more successful? So I really enjoyed that setting. That was my home. And it took me quite a while to find it, but because I did have a previous career, I wasn't a teacher for that long. Let's see, how long would it be? 15 years or so. When I retired in 2008, that was the setting that I left.
Wow, that's kind of, that's a history. Mm-hmm. My next question would be, what gave you the idea to start Club Impact?
In my later experiences with Portland Public Schools in the transition program, I just developed this opinion or sense that when students left the program at 21, they hopefully had a direction to go with employment and life skills. But one that I thought was lacking was social skill development and socialization. Students in the transition program really loved doing things socially with their peers there. And after a year or two in that setting, I saw a trend happening. The trend was that graduates came back to visit me and the others and other students, the program. And I could tell that they needed some social direction. They missed the program. They wanted to hang out with us. Oh, you guys are going downtown? Can I go with you? You know, stuff like that. And I would ask them questions about, well, what are you doing socially? Not a whole lot. So I had this idea to start a social club 2 or 3 years before I retired in 2008. I was pretty focused on that. I kept track of all of the students that I was their teacher from, and all that demographic information. I even had meetings after school with current students, and their parents were invited to talk about a postgraduate social club. And everybody really loved that idea. After I retired, I went to Impact Northwest, which at that time was called Portland Impact. And I've known that organization for a long time, by now around 30 years. So I had friends there, and even the director. And I went to her, Susan Stoltenberg, told her about my idea for Club Impact, what I wanted to do, and could Portland Impact host Club Impact, which we didn't have a name at that time, but host a social club. Susan was very supportive. I don't think we could have gotten it started without her. So it took me over a year to get through their hoops with Impact Northwest. And But we ended up with, we identified a place that we could use, which was at Tabor Square on Southeast Belmont Street. And then Impact Northwest offered to do our financial services. They also provided liability insurance, which is pretty big. You know, that's, I don't know how much that costs, but we didn't have to pay that. So we ended up with our liability coverage, using a space in this building for free, which is no small matter either. They did volunteer screening and some other stuff. In February of 2010, we started Club Impact. And remember, I had a whole kind of database of former students. So I mailed out invitations to all those people and their parents and some other people that were interested in the idea that might end up being volunteers. So the first night we had, you know, I can't even remember how many, maybe 20 people. And frankly, more than half of those were parents, because the parents are so concerned about and so attracted to this kind of thing, because they can see that it's a need for their son or daughter. So that kind of support is pretty useful for sure. So we started off, and it just kept growing and growing over the years. From 2010, when we started with maybe 20, we ended up in 2019, some events were over 100 people. The Monday night thing that we do, well, let me diverge onto that a little bit. Part of my idea, a big part, was we really needed to have weekly events. And I called it drop-in night every Monday night. And I really believe and still believe that frequency is very important for relationships to flourish. And I think that was right. In 2019, pre-pandemic, if you were a visitor to Club Impact on a Monday night, you would see a room with about 60 participants, maybe 20 or so care providers, a few parents, and a few volunteers. And we did all kinds of stuff. Celebrate birthdays, always food, you know, snacks.
Were you, sorry to interrupt, but I'm a little bit curious. Was the food, like, was that part of the original plan, or did that come in? Like, I mean, how did you find that resource?
Yeah, well, no, it started from day one. What we ended up with in 2019 was way more developed and more food than our beginnings. And you know, I can't remember exactly what we had in the beginning, but it was more termed as a light snack than where we are now is more like, wow, maybe we should call this dinner, you know, because there's so much food. And a lot of that is possible in the case of the food by Lisa Striplin, a longtime volunteer, and John Griffith as well was really an important factor in in serving up food.
I'm sorry, but you've had like some other volunteers as well, such as
John Garrow, excuse me.
John Garrow's, yes.
He's still around.
And I just can't remember them all. Jennifer.
Mahoney.
Mahoney, okay. And yeah, so many others.
Yeah. Well, we had some really key volunteers. Incidentally, I want to make the point, there's a lot of infrastructure required to run a thing like Club Impact. You do attendance, you keep track of all kinds of stuff. Jen was a really big help in setting up our, I'm calling it infrastructure, on a computer. Kind of my specialty area was special events, setting up special events. We had, I'm going to run through those just real brief. We had a thing called Oaks Park Day, where we go there, have a great big huge potluck, and club would provide grilled hamburgers, and participants would show up and they get a ride bracelet, go out on rides and come back, get something to eat, and then rush out, do it some more. Yeah, an event like that was 100 plus people. We haven't done that since, we didn't do it in 2020 or 21 because of the pandemic. Financial. John Garrow is real good at financial stuff. And John and myself were also the primary people dealing with a few challenging behaviors that came up. Okay, financially, we charged $2 entrance fee on a Monday night for participants only, not for others, providers, care providers, or volunteers, whatever.
Because you were trying to be stewards of that building, good stewards of that building. So didn't the participants also have to sign up for a chore or a task to help clean up and take care of the building?
Yeah. John Garrow was a person who oftentimes headed that up, signing up people to do it, making sure that they did it. One thing I'm really proud about, in a way, might not be the best strategy, but for all those years, we did not have any paid staff, all volunteers, myself included.
I'm just going to take a moment. This is Dina Wilder, sound engineer for Disability Justice, to just let you know that KBOO is in the middle of their fall membership drive. And we want to let you know that KBOO is supported by members, listeners like you. And if you would like to donate, you can go to kboo.fm/give. And we're hoping you're enjoying the program as John is speaking with Ralph Gillum, founder of Club Impact.
So let's see, where are we? We covered some of the things we do. Oh, like on a Monday night, I think I started to talk about that. We do birthdays, celebrations, we do karaoke. Once a month, we have a bingo game, which is probably the most popular.
It does sound like we've already covered number three, is what does Club Impact do? A social interaction for people with intellectual disabilities, is that fair to say?
Yeah, but we welcome and had people of any disability come. A lot of folks with autism, obsessive compulsive, a few of the physical limitations, like a few people in chairs, vision issues, and so on. Some participants really needed to come with a care provider to be successful. But there were half or maybe more than half that came without that. So quite a mixture of people.
Yeah. For the most part, you could kind of socialize with everybody there.
Yeah.
Really find some new friends and new connections.
Right. I'm on a enlarge on that if I could. I agree with that totally. That one of the, I just felt like Club Impact has been a family, and that people are relating to each other, whether they are participants or providers or parents or anything. There's very little focus on delineating the severity of a person's disability. Like you said, we're all there, we're having a good time, and we don't really care that much about our inabilities. We're here to have a good time.
So, Ralph, how has the pandemic interfered with Club Impact?
We used to have some annual events. One of those is the Oaks Park event. Another one is the Summer Blast. A third one that's wildly popular is an annual holiday dinner that we had ever since the very first year at Old Spaghetti Factory. That is so fun. I just love it because the biggest room they have there maxes out at about 125, and we fill it up. It's pretty amazing. They get dressed up for this. Some of them wear suits and ties and nice dresses. They're just glowing. And we have a few awards and acknowledgments. We use this as an opportunity to thank care providers, volunteers. Another event that we do is called Wrap It Up, where we get donated stuff, re-gift items, maybe things that people were going to take to Goodwill. I think one of the coolest parts about this is the participants, they know what's coming and they really love it. They go around to these tables, taking turns, picking out gifts, not for them, but for people on their Christmas list. I just think that's so cool. I remember comments from people saying that, you know, I've never been able to buy gifts for people that I am with, people that love me. This is the first time in my whole life when I have been able to do that. I mean, that's pretty special, I think. We set up wrapping tables, and so you go through the line, you pick out the toaster for your mother, and you take it down the line to another table, and you help the volunteer there wrap the toaster up. We have a few other kind of special events too on drop-in night or the Monday night besides Wrap It Up. Like, we'll have a Christmas party, we'll have a Valentine's Day party, Halloween party.
Yeah, so okay. What is your relationship to the ARC and what's your future plans for
Impact? Okay. Well, somewhere around 2017 or 18, I just felt like I didn't want to be the director of Club Impact anymore. I still want to be there and come, but the director is kind of a big responsibility. And, you know, I'm getting older. And so I started talking to different people, trying to find somebody that would want to be the director for free, like me. I mean, why not? So that did not happen. I worked on that for a couple of years and people were just not lining up to do that. I got a lead to talk to people at the ARC, and I did. We have a relationship going with the ARC now, transitioning to ARC leadership, and I'll tell you about that. But what's been hard, the hardest thing about that is these talks didn't start and planning didn't start until about when the pandemic started. And it's been really hard because we have not had for a year and a half plus any in-person events. We meet with the ARC and try to figure out, well, what can we do? Club Impact has a memorandum of understanding with the ARC to take it over. They'll come up with funding for a coordinator, liability insurance, financial management, and a few other things. And that agreement or understanding is in process right now. And it has been really slow going. It's hard. So, okay, you want to have a new director and we'll come up with something. It's been hard to fill that position. And I think that's related to the pandemic, but we're working on it. The only thing we are doing right now solidly is every Monday night we have virtual Club Impact where participants go online. We have bingo night. We have scavenger hunts. We sing happy birthday to people, watch a movie. That is somewhat successful in terms of numbers. 20, 30, maybe a little more than 30 people showing up.
It sounds like you're planning for the future of Club Impact.
Yeah.
Any ideas on what you hope the future of Club Impact would be?
Right. Well, it's currently, I'm still involved in it, trying to make it work because of this challenging time with the pandemic. And people at the ARC are trying to make it work. I'm holding on to that and putting in time doing that. It's more time than I really want to do. But I it's just hard for me to let go of it without knowing for sure that it's going to continue. And I think we're getting closer to a point where I won't have to keep going. And so, yeah, my vision for the future is that when it's safe, we move back into our place at Tabor Square and resume our special events. There's going to be, if and when we can move back in there, quite a transition, of course. The ARC has hired a part-time Club Impact coordinator. She's just started a week or so ago. So
will you be training her on, so if there's a new coordinator coming in for Club Impact, will you be giving her, all the past information and knowledge and experience that you've managed to accumulate over the years with Club Impact?
Really good question. Yes. When we go back to Tabor Square, I'm hoping that it won't be just me doing that kind of thing. I'm hoping that John Garrow will be there, Lisa Striplin, if she's able to, and others. Jen Mahoney won't be able to do it. Get this, Jen Mahoney hosts Virtual Club Impact. She's moved from Portland. She lives in Boise, Idaho now. But she loves clubs so much. She still gets a lot out of doing the virtual club. But when we go non-virtual, she's not going to be there.
Yeah, I hate to lose her.
Yeah.
Ralph, I want to thank you for coming in and, thank you for doing this interview with me. And I'd like to thank KBU for giving me this voice and giving Ralph this voice to tell the public about Club Impact.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Dear KBU listeners, I would first like to say thank you to KBU for giving a voice to those of us who do not have a voice. And so far as I know, the only one who has done this for our community. Please support them as they support us.
You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give. You can also click donate in mobile app or text KBOO to 44-321.
That's the end of Disability Justice. Since we cannot be fully aware of everybody's difficulties within the community, we would really like it if you would send us your email, disabilityjustice@kboo.org.
Also, we're always looking for fun, inexpensive things to do out in the community. Go to disabilityjustice@kboo.org to contact us and give us your ideas.
Portland.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kabu.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hi, my name is Lavanya, and I'm part of KABU's Youth Collective. I joined KABU because